Everybody, I'm Jeremy O'Clock.
Amen.
You know, at this group, we're committed to bringing speakers that carry the message. And we heard Adam Todd was available, that or he was considering coming into Atlanta. Like a lot of other times, we jumped on the bandwagon and pulled our resources and flew him in from Santa Monica. He did a great job, I heard, over at Glumlot last night. And if you want to hear him again, or if you know somebody that's missing him, he'll be over at Fifth Tradition Group tomorrow night. I got to know him a little bit over dinner, and it's an amazing thing. You know, we never met before. He's from California, and I'm from New York and here. And when you talk to someone that's very passionate about Alcoholics Anonymous, and in particular, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's amazing. You have this instant bond. And that's where our group has always been committed for, to bring you the message out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And with that, we'll bring you Adam Todd.
My name's Adam. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
Adam. Want to thank you guys for inviting me to come talk tonight. It's always an honor and a privilege to be asked to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. Ultimately, it's a responsibility to give back what was so freely given to me. Thank you, Jerry, for your hospitality. I know there's people here that heard me last night. I, you know, immediately want to do this whole thing backwards so no one recognizes me. But the only way I can change my story is if I drink. You know. But you know, I live in Southern California, and you know, every group has their perpetual newcomer. I know there's got to be a couple people here that are new that have been in and out, and you know, that was my story. I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous since I was like 17 years old, and I had so many chips and key tags I could have played poker with them. It was horrible. I mean, I remember one secretary saying, "Give them back." You know what I mean? And I did that walk of shame over and over and over again. And you know, there was so much guilt and shame. I think that almost killed me because I didn't want to come back. And I felt all of this judgment in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, we always say, you know, don't judge anybody in AA. You guys ever hear that? And then what do they tell you 5 minutes later? Stick with the winners. And the only reason I talk about those contradictions is because before I really got into the literature and did the work in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a prey to every opinion in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I really didn't understand what this program was. And, you know, I remember sitting in my counselor's office in detox in the therapeutic community, and he tells me, "Adam, don't make any major changes in your first year." So I come to an AA meeting, I get a sponsor. What's the first thing he tells me? "You got to change everything." Right? Sound familiar? Don't make any major decisions in your first year. Anybody seen The Third Step? How about don't get in a relationship in your first year? No one knows if that works. No one's ever done it. It's always a saint in the crowd, right? I always look for the guy that's not laughing. You got a halo, don't let it choke you. We talk about God a lot in AA, and it's a really hard thing to talk about. And one of the things they said to me is, you know, God doesn't give us more than we can handle. If that was really true, I wouldn't need God's help. And if you're new, you know, my experience with Alcoholics Anonymous is that I got to a place where I desperately needed God's help. I needed your help. And if you're new, you know, help is the dirtiest four-letter word in these rooms. The hardest thing for a drunk like me to do was to admit complete defeat, to get to a place where, you know, I had burned every bridge in my life. I had broken every relationship. I had worn everybody into the ground. And I tried all of the other stuff, the therapeutic community, psychiatry, religion, all the stuff. But, you know, and that's why we talk about Alcoholics Anonymous being the last house on the block. And eventually what happened to me with all that guilt and shame, I started coming to meetings loaded, you know. Now, the interesting thing about AA is you see a guy drunk in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting these days, people say stuff like, "Oh my gosh, what's he doing here?" Right? I mean, think about it. With the advent of treatment, which is, you know, now kind of like this multi-million dollar empire that swoops us up in our most desperate moments, you know, throws us into yoga class. Right? Craft hour. I'm making bombs in craft hour. Nature walks. You know, but what I would do is I'd go to 7-Eleven, I'd get a big gulp cup, I'd fill it up with liquor, I put a little Coca-Cola on top. And then I'd, you know, cruise into the late night Hollywood candlelight AA meeting. Do some of my best sharing. I know, no one thought that was funny. You know, and then I started appearing in treatment centers. By the way, you know what all the treatment centers and religions have in common? They all send their drunks to us. So I started going through treatment centers. And, you know, until I read the chapter to wives, because I'd never read the chapter to wives, you know, never had a wife of my own, you know. But the chapter to wives talks about four specific types of alcoholics. Type 1, type 2, type 3. And the fourth type of alcoholic in that chapter is the type that's been placed in one institution after another, that usually drinks on his way home from the hospital, that's more or less insanely drunken. And that was me. By the time I finally did get sober, I'd gone through treatment 28 times. Not 28 days like the movie, 28 consecutive times. I mean, I spent my entire inheritance on treatment. And I remember telling my sponsor, you know, I went through treatment 28 times. I was hoping that would, like, get rid of the guy, you know, loser. Maybe ruin his batting average. Go find someone that's willing. And he looks at me right in my eye and he says, you know, going through treatment 28 times, that doesn't make you an alcoholic. And I thought, you're kidding. He says, no, it means you paid $500,000 for a big book. And I didn't think that was funny either, you know. And I'm not going to start citing and quoting pages tonight out of the big book. But page 101 of the big book says, any scheme that attempts to shield the alcoholic from temptation is doomed to failure. See, treatment was a great place to fatten me up for another run, but treatment never solved the problem. And for me as an alcoholic, like a lot of us, I always thought the problem was booze. I mean, since I was a little kid, people had told me, why do you drink so much? Just quit drinking. Stop getting loaded. Just stop. I always thought the problem was alcohol. And if you're new, someone came up to me and said, Adam, you know, if alcohol's your problem, that drink, that shot glass, that 12-pack, if that's your problem, you're probably not an alcoholic. And then in the very next breath, he said to me, and if you are in fact an alcoholic, the type that's described in the doctor's opinion in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, your problem isn't alcohol. And you know what? It took me another decade to understand exactly what that guy was trying to explain to me. I mean, it was like some kind of cruel riddle. I drank over that for years. But I knew a couple things, and I got around a home group that was very specific on asking questions. And they asked me some very specific questions. And one of those questions was directed at the fact that if I really look at my history, and you might want to think about this if you're new, my history showed me that I couldn't live with alcohol. I could never really live with it. From the time I was in junior high school, which is like middle school now, I was already pissing in my pants, drooling on my desk, passed out under the bleachers. My nickname in eighth grade was Space Cadet. I couldn't find homeroom. Right? People are picking high schools. I'm picking rehabs. Right? Most likely to overdose. Everyone could see I couldn't live with alcohol. But see, alcoholism comes in people. It doesn't come in bottles. And the greater aspect of this spiritual disease centering in my mind points to the very simple fact that a drunk like me cannot live without alcohol. Not successfully, not happily. And in part what it means for me to be an alcoholic, if I really look at my history, is that I have a mind that continues to take me back to alcohol. If I really look at my relationship with booze, every time I got out of treatment, every time I got released from jail or an institution, every time I got out of a hospital, my mind would take me back to booze. It's almost like my default program. And like I was talking about last night, I was sponsoring this computer programmer, and he was so quick to point out the definition of a program. One of the definitions in the dictionary is a sequential set of instructions that brings about a result. Now, when you get a corrupt file in a computer, what do? You put in a recovery disk, right? It restores it to an earlier point in the process. You know, and Wilson uses the word process. Then he tells me that 10 and 11 are like the viral scan. And the only reason I say that is for many, many years, I had confused the program with the fellowship. And I'd been thinking that I would get recovery from sitting in these rooms. And you know what? It's not going to come up through the chair. I didn't understand that. That what I found in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and what you'll find if you're new, is you'll find enthusiasm. You'll find encouragement. You'll find inspiration. You will find hope. But until I sat down with a sponsor and started to really go through these very specific instructions in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I never kind of found the kind of recovery that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous when I really did the work. And up until that point, if you asked me how I was doing, I would say, I'm hanging in there. People would say stuff like, dude, I'll buy you a drink if it's that bad. You know what I mean? And that's the problem with me, is that without doing the work in Alcoholics Anonymous, an alcoholic of this type will get sicker. Being in a 12-step program and not working the 12 steps is like staying in a 5-star hotel and living in the bathroom. And I never understood that until I did the work. I never understood that. I had sat in purgatory for 17 years. And I never knew how free I could be. I never knew that there really was a roadmap to spiritual success, a design for living, a way of life here that could really set someone like me completely free and a little bit on fire. And the only reason people like me are on fire about it is because we suffered so bad. You know, Larry was saying last night, you know, someone came up to him, and I hear it all the time, how did you end up speaking at all these meetings? You know, flying around, and Larry said, because he pissed God off really good. You know, and I'm so grateful to be here with you guys. And I, you know, what I found here last night in that meeting is something that we seem to be losing in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is the adherence to the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for me, that's what really happened. And in LA, we have like 2,500 meetings in Los Angeles. And a lot of them are dog and pony shows. I mean, you know, they look really good, but no one really, there's a lot of people suffering that think that the fellowship is the program. And that misunderstanding almost killed me. You know, part of my problem, again, as an alcoholic, and you might want to ask yourself this, is that my failure in AA was to do a lot with my defiance towards spiritual principles. And one of my problems as an alcoholic is that, you know, I will argue with anybody about anything at any time. You tell me it's black, I'll tell you it's white. You tell me it's big, I'll tell you it's small. You tell me to go left, I'll go right with an attitude. Sound familiar? And what that really means for me is that you can lead me into the gates of hell, but you can't push me into heaven. That denial almost killed me. Denial is an acronym, by the way. It stands for don't even notice I am lying. Think about it. You could tell an alcoholic, but you can't tell them much. Oh, you don't believe it? Try sponsoring somebody. So what happened to me is I got to one more treatment center. I was dying of alcoholism. I was 120 pounds. I'm going to break tradition. I'd been on methadone maintenance for 10 years, okay? But I am an alcoholic. And I'm sitting in this detox. I look like I just got out of a concentration camp. You know, I'm dirty, and I've let everybody down one more time. Remember that great feeling in detox? A couple of you guys were probably just there, right? And, you know, I'm sitting in this detox circle with my fellow associates. You know, a vision for you, right? And this woman from AA comes in on her H&I panel. H&I stands for hospitals and institutions, by the way. I think you have a similar thing, treatment and institutions or something. But hospitals and institutions is a committee that brings meetings into prisons and detoxes, hospitals, treatment centers, anywhere where clients, patients, or inmates can't get to meetings. H&I probably has the lowest relapse rate in all of recovery. Like I was saying last night, I mean, we have like 250 people at our H&I meeting, and they're fighting to get on panels. And a panel is where you go into a treatment center and talk to people about Alcoholics Anonymous. They're like literally pushing each other out of the way to get there. And this woman's on her H&I panel, and I'm, you know, I'm sitting in my nightgown with my ass hanging out. And of course, I'm judging the speaker. Think about it. We're the only people that can be on the curb and look down at the world, right? I got two speeds, grandiose and comatose. And I'm strutting around detox in my nightgown, bragging about robbing Brinks trucks. Right? I do my four-step. It's a bread truck. And it's empty. So this woman's talking about AA. And At the end of her talk, she looks us all up and down and she says, if I could give you the gift of recovery, I wouldn't do it. And I remember looking at her and I looked at the guy next to me and I said, what a bitch. And then she said something that would later change my life. She said, the reason I wouldn't give you the gift of recovery is because I wouldn't rob you of the journey. Now, all of these years later, I understand that that journey to recovery, just like that journey to surrender that each and every one of us has to walk, it's personal. We can't give you that gift of desperation. And that gift of desperation is a great acronym for God. But for me, like a lot of us, until I got to that place where my head couldn't get enough and my body couldn't take any more, that place where I was at death's door, like I got to AA the day before I died. That's the way I felt the last time I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was one of the things that brought about a willingness like no one could have ever given me. But, you know, when your head can't get enough and your body can't take any more, God means something totally different to a drunk like me. It means grow or die. Then I understand what it means to drink against my will. And you know what? Until that point, I had no clue as to what you guys had here. It was almost like I was doing this out of compliance, which is cooperation without agreement. And I was sitting in these rooms, daydreaming. I wasn't where I was never where my feet were. Because I still had a plan. Or I just wasn't done. And you know what? I've learned not to judge those people. Like, you know, the big book says half of us got sober right away. The other 25% with significant tries. And then there's another portion that just shows improvement. And you know what? I've learned to absolutely love the people that show improvement. And I thank God because of my failure and all the people in my life that have died, my family members, you know, that were good people, that maybe were constitutionally incapable or didn't have the capacity. I truly, truly understand what that is now. And I don't judge anybody. You know, that's the most beautiful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new, this thing is the closest thing to unconditional love that a drunk like you or me will ever experience. No matter how many lives I destroyed, how many promises I broke, how many hearts I broke, how many jobs I lost, how many cars I wrecked, how many despicable, disgusting things that we do on that journey to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. If you're new, remember that. That collectively there is love here. It may not come from individuals, but I know that Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole has always loved me and embraced me. And I will be forever grateful for that. Because I was a teenager in AA. I was 17. And, you know, I would... You know, the old timers in AA at that point would say stuff like, oh, we spilled more than you drank. And we're like, we didn't spill any. That's why we got here sooner, right? And I get that. And I also understand if you're new now, when they used to say that AA is a $1 million program, shoved up your butt a nickel at a time, I didn't understand what they meant by that. But now, all of these years later, when I hear what they used to say about Alcoholics Anonymous being the most expensive club on earth, I know what they mean. And it wasn't about that $500,000. It was about giving away everything that mattered to me. It took it all. It's selfish. It took it all. But see, there's another thing about that. The other side of that coin is that alcoholism is the only disease, when treated, that will actually leave the sufferer in a better position than if they never had the disease. And I could only believe that when I really got into the work, when I started to take actions in Alcoholics Anonymous that I didn't believe. And if you're new, that was what I was asked to do, to set aside everything I thought I knew about God, about AA, about the 12 steps, so I could have a new experience with this. Because my old ideas were killing me. And I didn't understand that until I started to actually take these very deliberate actions. It's like a roadmap. You have to know where you are to find out where you're going. And that is a lot of what the inventory did for me, is it showed me through discovery those places where I had delusional thinking. Like we say, alcoholism is the only prison where the key's inside. And by the way, if you're new, we're the only people that want a reward because we ran out of a burning building. You know? I mean, if you're new and you're feeling heroic because you gave up your big, Friday night to hang out with us? This is the only place on God's earth where they'll applaud because you came in to save your own life. Right? I mean, think about it. If you're sitting here thinking about drinking, that beats the hell out of being in a bar tonight thinking about getting sober. And I have to remember that. You know, we talk about, oh, my worst day sober is better than my best day drinking. And we're all like, really? Let me tell you something. Think about this. My worst day sober is so much better than my last day drinking. The last 5 years of being spit on and being... My parents on the holidays would give me $100 and say, get out of here. You're shaming the... It was disgusting. You know, my mom moved and didn't leave a forwarding address. That's where it ended. Because I had driven my family into the ground. And everyone around me. And I had to live like that to get to a place where I became willing to take actions here that I didn't believe in. In fact, if I really look at it, it's almost like the disease killed me every day and it wouldn't bury me. It was like this perpetual state of misery. And I remember at that point, when I got sober, my sponsor looked at me and he says, you know, you ought to buy a black suit. And I said, why? And he said, well, you know, if you stick around AA, if you do, you're going to go to a lot of funerals. It'll come in handy. Then he said something really nice. He said, oh, and by the way, if you drink again, at least we'll have something nice to bury you in. And you know what? If you baby the alcoholic, you'll bury him. I know most of the people in this room know somebody that's died of alcoholism or addiction. This is a fatal, progressive, chronic disease. It's like being on a train and the train only goes to one place. It goes to jails, institutions, and death. Right now we're at a station. And I feel protected. But see, my understanding now of powerlessness doesn't mean I can't drink again. My experience with powerless over alcohol seems to mean that I will drink again. That I have no effective mental defense against the first drink. That like the book says, I can't bring into my consciousness with sufficient force the pain and suffering of a week or a month ago. It means I never took my first drink drunk. This mind will continue to take me to that place. And I have to look at how I establish that way of thinking because it happens over a period of time. Just like recovery is progressive, I believe the disease is progressive. And, you know, going through treatment 28 times, I started speaking a foreign language. You guys know that we speak a foreign language in treatment. It's called victimese. Sound familiar? I don't understand how the drink bone connects to the jail bone. It's kind of like I met her in rehab. I can't believe she drank. Oh, yeah. Were you surprised when that happened? You know, I knew he was a crackhead. I can't believe he stole my iPad. Hello? Met her at the strip club. Can't believe she cheated. This is called delusion, okay? And for me, like a lot of us, I had to eventually see through inventory how I make decisions based on self that later leave me in a position to be hurt. Because if I cannot connect those dots through this process, I will continue to play victim. It's almost like me walking around in the world saying, I'm powerless over everything. I know it sounds great, but if that's true, then I'm not responsible for anything. And if I'm not responsible for anything, I automatically become a victim. And until I really understand how I made those decisions based on self, I couldn't get free of this. You know, and I continue to take inventory. Last night I said the same thing. You know, continuing to take inventory is kind of like going to the ATM machine. Now, it's a peculiar analogy, but when you go to the ATM machine, what do? You put in the card, you put in the code, you take your money, right? You put in the card, you put in the code, you take your money, you put in the card, you put in the code. And after a while, you're like, I get it. And you stop doing it. And my friend said, yeah, but what's going on behind the wall? And I said, my goodness, the account's being debited. See, that seems to be the phenomenon of living in 10, 11, and 12, is that eventually I become separated from the emotions that used to own me. Just like the word resentment, it means to take an event from my past, to attach emotion to it, and then to re-feel it, relive it, reenact it in every area of my life. My life is like Groundhog Day. And I got a button on my forehead that says, push me. And I continue to play victim. So really, it's like normal people seem to be intellect over emotion. They think, they process, and they act. I'm exactly the opposite. I'm emotion over intellect. I act, process, and then think. Oops, 10th step. I mean, come on. We're the only people that burn bridges ahead of us. If you're laughing, you're relating. Wherever there's hysterics, there's historics. Wherever I have an emotional response, I have to write inventory. I have history. And what happens through doing that again and again and again is eventually I start to become emotionally separated from all those events. Most of them were set in my childhood, and I never saw it. And that seems to me to be very much part of the dysfunction that fuels my alcoholism. It has nothing to do with the phenomenon of craving, but it is that which takes my mind back to drinking. And it became critical that I understand that. If it wasn't important, you know, we wouldn't have had all of this inventory and this approach to the psychic change through this process. It's a very systematic approach to bringing about a change. And they'll tell you, if you don't change, your sobriety, they will. That's what they told me. And I very much am in tune with why I drank, because I continued to go through that process. And, you know, for me, fear won't keep me sober. I don't know about you guys, but, you know, getting a third strike, living on the street, being homeless, losing my big career, throwing away my education. Did scared straight work for you guys? That went right over my head. Now, the big book illustrates the problem drinker as someone that can stop or moderate given sufficient reason, right? Huge difference between a problem drinker and a real alcoholic. Think about it. You got a problem drinker and a real alcoholic in a jail cell for, say, drunk driving. You got two completely different philosophies going on. You get the problem drinker over here on one side of the cell thinking, God, why'd I drink so much last night? I knew I shouldn't have drank so much. Real alcoholics over here on the other side of the cell thinking, why'd I take I-85? Now, the court card people never laugh at that joke, right? That's not funny. You should have stayed on Surface Streets. You could have been home cleaning your pipe tonight. Victim. Problem drinker's wife says, honey, if you don't stop drinking, I'm leaving you, right? Problem drinker cleans up his act, doesn't drink in the house, gets a little Visine. Now, if my woman says, honey, if you don't stop drinking, I'm leaving you, you know what I'm thinking, right? I'm thinking about single life. I mean, you want to see drama in the life of an alcoholic? Get between an alcoholic and a drink. Remember what that's like? You want to see drama in my life? Get between me and AA. See, alcohol was the love of my life. If anything got in the way of booze, it was out of my life. I mean, alcohol completed me. It had me from hello. If anything got in the way of booze, it was out of my life. You think I'm going to let go of the love of my life without a fight? I can't even let go of a bad relationship. Everything I let go of, that's claw marks all over it. And my experience with AA has been identical to that. If anything gets in the way of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's out of my life. A woman, a relationship, I don't care how beautiful she is, how much she loves me, how great she makes me look. I remember the first time I said that from a podium, there she was in the back of the room. She's like, honey, you don't look like an alcoholic. Oh my goodness, why do you got to go to all those meetings? Oh, you're not speaking again, are you? It's the weekend. Next thing she tells me, you know that AA thing, it's getting in the way of our relationship. So a couple months later, it's Thanksgiving dinner. It's, you know, it's the big night, right? I'm going to meet her parents. It's meet the parents night. So I'm all dressed up, head of the table. Out comes the exotic wine. I'm sitting there. You know, she says, honey, you can have one glass of wine. Oh, come on. It's just a glass of wine, sweetie. It's Thanksgiving. It's natural wine. I know, four more rehabs. I know, I stole her purse that night. It's true. Went down to the hood and got an outside issue. Yeah. And she came to detox with a get well card. I know, I got 4 cards from that one. Now, I love Al-Anon family groups. I don't want to offend anybody tonight. I come from a long line of alcoholism. But, you know, for her, a slip was 10 minutes of compassion.
Yeah.
I tried to send her to Codependence Anonymous. She wouldn't go. You know why? She didn't have anyone to go with. That's awful. Should I get a little more graphic? You guys know the difference between a codependent and a toilet seat? The toilet seat doesn't follow you around after you poop all over it. I know that's horrible. But see, I have alcoholism and suicide on both sides of my family, and I had to understand the principles of Al-Anon. I didn't cause it. I can't control it. I can't cure it. I was told to mind my own business and have some business to mind. Because if you're an alcoholic, chances are you probably come from an alcoholic home. And it's almost like this. The genetics loads the gun, the dysfunction pulls the trigger. There's a lot of people that have the genetic component of alcoholism. They don't have the dysfunction. They're normal in every respect except the effect produced by alcohol. Then there's people that have the dysfunction and not the genetic part. You know, and they have 10 different programs for those people. But I seem to have both. And you know how many Al-Anons it takes to screw in a light bulb? None. The Al-Anon detaches and lets it screw itself. Right? And if that was true, we wouldn't have half the treatment centers we do. I have sponsees that pay more in taxes than I earn all year. They have these huge careers and these little tiny programs. I've never seen one of them stand the test of time here. What do I do for a living? I stay sober. Oh, what do I do for money? That's over there. If I get those two things mixed up, I'm back in handcuffs. I get those two things mixed up, I'm back in an emergency room. Or I get a double header, I'm handcuffed to a gurney in an emergency room. But that has consistently been my experience. Puke smells the same in a Mercedes, if you haven't noticed. For me as an alcoholic, and if you're new, I had to see that there's a direct relationship between willingness and surrender. You ever notice you'll never see anybody more willing to work this program than the guy that comes crawling through the back door of an AA meeting after a long, hard run? Remember what that's like? At that point, I'll do anything, right? 90 meetings in 90 days. First day out of detox, I got 3 sponsors. I want to take the whole coffee pot home with me. I don't even have a trunk to put it in, right? And 30, 60, 90 days later, I'm saying, you mean we got to go to meetings every day? And like a prize fighter, what I do is I throw in the towel and then I take that towel back one little piece at a time. And it's critical that I see that. That I slowly go back to drinking. And the very things that Alcoholics Anonymous gives me, the pretty girl, the big house, the nice job, are the things that become more important than my program. It's almost like what I do is I build Alcoholics Anonymous around my big life, and as my life gets bigger, you know what happens? AA becomes really inconvenient, especially service. And if you're new, what I've had to do in order to stay here is I've had to build my life around Alcoholics Anonymous. And by doing that, it's grown tenfold. It's almost counterintuitive. It's like Mahatma Gandhi said, I've got so much to do today, I'm going to have to meditate twice as much. And the more I've invested in Alcoholics Anonymous, the crazier it's become because it's got bigger. Most of my problems died from neglect. Think about it. You give an alcoholic a problem, you know, I'll water it, right? Give me a rut, I'll furnish it. And what happened to me, like a lot of us, is most of those problems dissipated from neglect. The things that I thought were so important. You know, and I really have to look at that because I come into AA with this act of surrender over and over again. And there's a big difference between the act of surrender and the state of surrender. The act of surrender that gets the newcomer here and the state of surrender that keeps the old timer here, it's a completely different concept. It's kind of like watching a swan glide across a pond of still water. It's so beautiful. It's so effortless. It's so graceful. But you know what that swan's doing under the water? He's paddling like hell, right? And, you know, we have a chapter in the big book, by the way, Into Action. Have you noticed there's no chapter into feelings? I know the therapists hate that one. No chapter into thinking? We ought to have a chapter into whining, right? From the podium. At the noon meeting. I'm like, dude, get a job. And for me, like a lot of us, I became willing to take actions in Alcoholics Anonymous that I didn't believe in. That triangle, recovery, unity, and service, translates into three specific actions. It's almost like a verb. And what those actions are is contribute, belong, and learn. Service is to contribute, belong is unity, to learn is to uncover, discover, and discard what's blocking me. And it's almost by default. It's like when they asked Michelangelo, how did you make the Statue of David? Michelangelo said, I never made the Statue of David. I just chipped away everything that wasn't David, and there he was. And that simple idea, me taking these actions consistently over a period of time, the product of contributing, belonging, and learning is that I feel wanted, needed, and loved. Just like in The Keys to the Kingdom. If you ever read that story, it's a beautiful story that's in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it talks about those basic ideas. In the religious community, we talk about wisdom, power, and love. If you really look at the steps, they produce wisdom. Unity produces power. Service produces love. So for me, I became willing to take actions that I didn't believe in. And that's what my sponsor said. Why don't you try it as an experiment? Do everything we suggest. Do the whole thing for a year. If it doesn't work, we'll gladly refund your misery. And you know what? When I had never done that. I had never done the whole deal. And when I did, I looked back at my life a year later and I thought, God, I thought, how did you ever live like that? But before that, all I'd done is sat in meetings. And talked about my problems. You know, and I would go from one meeting to another looking for sympathy. And I got a little sympathy. But I didn't get recovery. I did not get recovery. See, for me, self-knowledge won't fix me. I've had every relapse prevention class known to man. You know, and I'm back in class, learning about my triggers. You know, in my nightgown. I'm like, counselor, counselor. Waking up's a trigger for me. I'm awake. It's like, sir, will you please go back to your dorm? Button up your nightgown. And I'm on Skid Row again. Drunk. Behind a dumpster. Reciting chapter 5 out of the big book. And the bum next to me is like, dude, will you shut up? You're ruining my high. And I'm crying because I can't get back here. Because I got a head full of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got a belly full of booze, and I'm separate, different, and alone one more time. You think that sounds painful? You know what could be worse than that? Being in this room tonight, being a real alcoholic, and not working the 12 steps. It could be worse. There's no anesthetic. Coming to meetings late, leaving early, not having commitments, not having a sponsor, not being in the steps, not doing service. It could be more painful. That's why, you know, we have all these moments of, you know, these milestones, right? 30, 60, 90 days of recognition. We should have a moment of recognition for the guy in his last 30 days. You can always spot him. Just ask him how he's doing. I'm fine. I'm like, really? Why don't you tell your face that? But you always hear about him later. Remember so-and-so that used to sit up front right here? Killed himself. Overdosed. Back in prison. See, I know what it's like to sit in a room like this full of happy people and have that awful ache in the heart of every alcoholic that no one knows about. That loneliness that has nothing to do with the closeness or proximity to other people, but my inability to connect with others. I know what that's like. I know what it's like to sit in a room like this and make a decision to get loaded. You know what? I'm puking my guts out before I get to the liquor store. It's almost like the phenomenon of craving just takes me. And you think at that point I'm going to call my sponsor? It's the last guy I'm going to call. And I know that for me. That for most of my early experience with Alcoholics Anonymous, I was one decision away from a drink. There was nothing between me and that decision. And today, there's a whole world called recovery. There's people like you, there's rooms like this, there's commitments, there's traditions. And the collective of all of that is this mystery we call God. And all of that, it's like being on a merry-go-round. You know, I can hang on the edge of that merry-go-round, and if If I come off it, no one's even going to notice. But I get in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous, just like the herd mentality. I will not get picked off. And I know that to be true. It's like, you know, the difference between being in the program and on the program, it's kind of like the difference between being in a submarine or on a submarine. Oh, yeah, when the ship takes a dive, you'll find out if you're in it or on it. I remember telling my sponsor I had a degree when I came to AA. You know what he said to me? He said, Adam, thermometers have degrees. You know where they stick those? He was so mean. But see, knowledge is necessary to win the confidence of a newcomer, where no one else could, where the clergy couldn't do it, where the therapist couldn't do it, where the drug and alcohol counselor couldn't do it, where the parole officer couldn't do it. Another alcoholic was able to win my confidence because he lived like me. He felt like I did. Not just drinking, but in untreated alcoholism, in selfishness, in dishonesty, in resentment, in fear, that corroding threat. That was untreated alcoholism, and that's what another drunk was able to share with me. You ever notice at the end of these meetings we say, keep coming back, it works if you work it? We don't say, keep coming back, it works if you know it. And what I discovered is this is not, for me, an intellectual pursuit. The recovery only happens through action. And until I understand what the problem is, the solution's not going to work. And part of that problem for me as an alcoholic is that when I stop drinking, the outsides get better, but the insides get worse. That's not true for everybody. But for me, the longest bridge that I will ever cross, the longest journey that I will ever walk as an alcoholic, is that little tiny hyphen between the first and second half of step one. What that really means is I've got a body that can't process alcohol, but more importantly, I have a mind that can't process reality. And what I had thought for years is because I drink, therefore my life is unmanageable. That's only a half-truth. That's like looking at the broken home, the ruined marriage, the financial destitution, the poor health, and thinking that that's the problem. In fact, that's what treatment told me the problem was. They told me the trigger was on the outside. Just change people, places, and things. But you know what Alcoholics Anonymous eventually showed me? That the trigger was on the inside. You ever notice when an alcoholic's not having a good day? You know when it is, right? It's when I'm not getting my way. Think about it. We're all like five-year-old kids here with old people's faces. Oh, you don't believe it? Cross one of us. I'll resent you for decades. And your grandkids. The problem with resentment, again, is that I take poison and I hope you die. Resentment is like an acid. It only eats the container it's in. So for me, if I really look at what the greater aspect of this spiritual problem is, it's the second half of step one. And what that is my need to play God. My need to be right. My need to sort and compare and judge and label. It's my severe overreaction to five things: abandonment, rejection, betrayal, disrespect, and authority. And they're all driven by fear. Fear of abandonment. Fear of betrayal. Fear of disrespect. Fear of rejection. Fear of authority. And what the book says is I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, which is my faulty relationship with God based on self-reliance. It's 1,000,000 miles wide. It's 1,000,000 miles high, but it's paper thin. And what happened is another drunk showed me how to continue to walk through that fear until I saw that it wasn't real, that it was an illusion. And it becomes faith. It's almost like they say you can't be fear and faith at the same time. Sometimes I'll argue that. But it seems that if I keep my eye on God and on this program, you know, I've seen so many people walk through fire here. You know, I've walked through the death of one of my parents, all that stuff. All that stuff. You know, and I thank God that I never did it alone. I remember when my mom was dying, and I was talking in a meeting, and I just mentioned to one person that my mom was on her deathbed. And because I kept my private life kind of private. And within a day, I had 10 people in AA call me and say, yeah, I lost my mom too. And they walked me through that. And that's what Jerry was talking about at the beginning of this meeting, is that, you know, I travel a lot, and I travel just for fun too. And whenever I travel, I find a directory and I find meetings before I go, no matter where I go. And within minutes, we make friendships that are just unbelievable. I because we have, in a way, this same personality profile. We have a common problem, and we have a common solution. And, you know, we question what the common problem is. I heard it tonight. I mean, you know, you come into an AA meeting these days, and you've got, you know, and I don't want to offend anybody, but, you know, you've got alcoholics, then you got addicts, then you got addict alcoholics, then you got alcoholic addicts, right? They're somehow different. And of course, we get the dope fiends in the back that are worse than all of us. And my experience with alcoholism, if I don't have a common problem, I don't have a common solution. And I start to look at what that spiritual maladjustment is when I'm not drinking. Because you put, we were talking about, you put booze in front of me, it doesn't have a problem. The greater aspect of this disease, this spiritual maladjustment, centers in my mind. And when Bill Wilson originally wrote that 12th step, he said, you know, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we carry this message to others, especially alcoholics. Anybody that does this work can benefit from the 12 steps. In fact, Bill Wilson was in Time magazine as being responsible for the largest social movement of the last century. AA has affected somewhere between 40 to 50 million people worldwide. And you know why I don't think it's going to work for a drunk like me? Because it wasn't my idea. There's too much evidence that this works. There's too many of us that have recovered and are happy. That seems to be the test, to be sober and happy. That's the trick. And that's what I didn't really understand for a long time. It's that, you know, for me, thinking it through doesn't work. Oh, just play the tape through. I play the tape through back to Skid Row. You know what my head tells me? Oh, Skid Row wasn't that bad. Right? Toothless honey, cardboard box. I can make it on Skid Row. I know normies don't think that's funny. I mean, that's the insanity of alcoholism. You know what insanity is, right? We talk about insanity doing the same thing and expecting different results. That's not the insanity I live with. I have a completely different brand of insanity. It's doing the same thing, knowing exactly what's going to happen and what? Doing it anyway. At least the other kind of insanity, doing the same thing and expecting different results, at least there's some hope there. But see, the insanity I deal with is brought about a lot of times by spiritual pain. It's not that I justify and rationalize it. It's that my life becomes so absolutely unbearable. And I look at my life with alcohol. You know, alcohol is what gave me the courage to ask that pretty girl to dance, to go after that big job. Alcohol gave me the wings to fly. And when I'm not drinking, I'm chasing you four exits past my exit on the freeway. I'm counting your items in the checkout line. I mean, I remember my mom saying, gosh, drink, you were nicer. And unless I can find that sense of comfort and ease that I'm seeking from alcohol through this process, there's no way I'm going to stay here. You know, we were talking about like having sex with a gorilla. Now, if you have sex with a gorilla, it's not over till the gorilla says it's over. Right? I know it's a little graphic. You get that gorilla back in the cage, it starts looking at you again with those loving eyes. Remember how it used to be, just me and you? Come on, honey, I promise I won't hurt you this time. It reminds me of the story about this guy that gets a rifle for his birthday. And his lifelong ambition was to shoot a polar bear. He's a hunter, right? So he goes up to the tundra and he's got his new rifle and he sees this polar bear and he takes his shot and he's over looking at his kill. And there's a tap on his shoulder. It's a bigger polar bear looking down at him. And the polar bear says, you know, you just shot my son. You got two choices. Either let me have my way with you, or I'm going to maul you to death. So, you know, he's in the hospital healing up. Now he's got a resentment. So he goes back up there. He's looking for the bear, right? He's got his gun. He sees the bear. He takes his shot. He goes over and looks at his kill. Tap on his shoulder. Bigger polar bear. Polar bear says, you just shot my uncle. You got two choices. You either let me have my way with you, or I'm going to maul you to death. So he's back in the hospital again. And this goes on for years, back and forth, back and forth. Finally, he's up there. He sees the the bear. It's the one. He takes his shot. He's over looking at his kill. Tap on his shoulder. It's the king of the polar bears looking down at him. And the bear says, you know, we've been watching you. You're not really up here for the hunting, are you? Now, if you think that's insane, read the Jaywalker in the Big Book, because the parable is identical. It's identical. And that's what I didn't understand about alcoholism. It says that we are driven. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-pity. You know, when they drive cattle, when four horsemen drive a herd of cattle, if you're in the center of that herd, you don't know where you're being driven. You know where you're going, to the slaughterhouse. And I didn't understand that I was driven by selfishness. I was driven by resentment. I was driven by fear. I was driven by that delusion that I was talking about. And the interesting thing about alcoholism is, you know, in chapter 5, we read chapter 5. Do you guys read chapter 5 a lot here? In Southern California, they read it in every meeting. That's when most people go into text mode, right? And at the end of chapter 5, it says, our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas, right? A, that I'm an alcoholic and I can't manage my own life. B, that probably no human power can relieve my alcoholism. And C, that God could and would have sought. And I'm thinking, before and after what? But see, for an alcoholic, it's before and after I stop drinking. A lot of people I drank with come to AA, and as soon as they stop drinking, everything works for them. They fit in, they're part of, the career welcomes them back. They come to meetings once a year, take another anniversary, never work a step, and their life gets consistently better. They've been serene since their ass hit the seat in AA. It's not my experience. My experience, every time I stop drinking, the first thing they say to me is, boy, you need to be on medication. Why are you so angry? Why are you so emotional? What's wrong with you? Why can't you sit still over there? And I'm crying at dog food commercials. See, for me, I have a whole other set of problems, and they're outlined on page 52 of the Big Book. And what that is when I'm not drinking, I can't control my emotional nature. When I'm not drinking, I'm a prey to misery and depression. When I'm not drinking, I can't manage my personal relationships. Sound familiar? When I'm not drinking, I'm full of fear. When I'm not drinking, I'm of no use to other people. When I'm not drinking, I'm basically unhappy. And the way that plays out for me in untreated alcoholism is I don't fit in, I'm not part of, you don't understand me, everybody's in my way, life's not fair, they're not paying me enough, she's cheating on me, I gotta drink. And something magic happens. I pick up a cocktail, and I intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle me. Think about it. A couple more drinks, fear of people and economic insecurity leave me. I'm buying the whole bar drinks. Hell, I'll write you a check. Not only are you getting better looking, honey, I'm getting better looking. Right? Give me a couple Vicodin, I could comprehend the word serenity, and I know peace. Give me a little cocaine, I want to start a business with you. Right? Get me down to my last 20 bucks. I'll show you how my experience will benefit others. I lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in my fellows, right? I'm calling people from fifth grade. I love you. Sound familiar? That was before Facebook. See, alcohol creates the illusion that my life is manageable. If you're laughing at any of that, there's something terribly wrong with you guys. That does not occur in the normal or temperate drinker. Think about it. Alcohol's classified as a depressant. 9 out of 10 people, they have a couple drinks and they say, whoa, I got to slow down. I'm feeling it. I have a couple drinks and, honey, I want to get married. I want to go to Vegas. I'm trying to find the car keys I hid for myself before the first drink. See, for me, alcohol's a stimulant. And that's what makes me bodily and mentally different from my fellows. Not how much I drink, not how often I drink, but that effect produced by alcohol is so elusive in me that I cannot differentiate the true from the false. We were talking about everything being black and white, and suddenly it's technicolor. Everything seems possible. And that magic is only produced in this classification of people. In fact, what it does so much for me, I don't care what it's doing to me. And that's what the earth people don't understand about us. Or the Al-Anons, I'm sorry. You know, they can't understand why we drink, and we don't know why you don't. But as alcoholics, we know exactly why we do. Because life has its moments, and for those very moments, a drunk like me will give my life. I will make the supreme sacrifice just to feel that sensation. That sensation is so elusive. It's so interesting because at the end of the promises, what it says at the end of the promises, we suddenly realize that God could do for us what we could not do for ourselves. Didn't some of us suddenly realize that alcohol had done for us what we could not do for ourselves? If that's really true, then there's a relationship between God and alcohol. You get into the ghettos in this country where everything's been burned to the ground, there's always two things that stick out: churches and liquor stores. You know why? Because they both give man hope. And if you're new and you're an alcoholic, see, hope doesn't matter to a drunk like me until I become hopeless. It really won't matter to me until I'm fresh out of plans, until I've burned my life to the ground. Then God gets my attention. There's three prayers in this life. One is, God, help me. Remember saying that? I always tell people, you know, we have a chapter, We Agnostics, in the big book. When you're wrapped around a toilet puking your guts out, all you say is, oh, God. All you know is God. Right? Remember? Get a couple days sober, it's like, there's no God. Right? So funny. So there's three prayers. One is, God, help me. The other is, God, give me. It's the greatest distraction on earth. But the third prayer is, God, use me. And I end up in the middle of Georgia. And I'm so glad to be here. I can't tell you how glad I am to be here. I drank for mind expansion and pain reduction. You know what I got, right? Pain expansion and mind reduction. My life was so small. It was like there was nothing left, this little ember. And Alcoholics Anonymous blew on that, and it's become this fire. You know, and every single one of us has an opportunity to turn this thing around and turn this seemingly cursed thing into a blessing. I just had to be willing to set aside some old ideas, to let go of my resistance. The opposite of admission for me is really denial. And it's not denial about the problem. If you're new, it's never denial about the problem that stops me from having a good life. Again, it's denial about the solution. That this plan of action, this roadmap to spiritual success, like I said before, won't work for me. And I had to set aside those old ideas. If you added up my three relationships coming into AA, my relationship with God, plus my relationship with others, plus my relationship with myself, and you put an equal sign under it, you know what it would equal, right? Detox. But I still thought I had it going on. And I started to understand, Chuck C. used to say that, the real problem here isn't alcohol. The real problem is a conscious separation from God. And then he points to the solution, which is a conscious contact with God. And you know, for me, that bridge from 2 to 11 is steps 4 through 9. Maybe what they should say in AA is, rarely have we seen a person fail that's done steps 4 through 9. Rarely have we ever seen anybody do 4 through 9. Right? I do the AA waltz, 1, 2, 3, drink, 1, 2, 3, drink. 1, 2, 3. I'll turn my will and life over to anything but that which will solve my problem. And what the big book says is, when I straighten out spiritually, only then do I straighten out mentally and physically. I know we're running out of time here. If someone did to me what I did to myself, I would have killed them. Ask yourself that question. If someone did to me what I did to others, I would have killed them. And then I come to AA and you want me to pray to God? I didn't want God to find out where I was. See, I had become bankrupt in those three simple relationships. That's the conscious separation from God. If you really look at the 12 steps by design, steps 1 through 3 recreate and develop a relationship with God. 4 through 7 recreate and develop a relationship with self. 8 and 9 recreate and develop a relationship with others. It's real simple. 10 maintains my relationship with self. 11 maintains my relationship with God. And 12 through service maintains, develops, and grows my relationship with others. So coming out of the steps, I'm able to live in harmony in those simple, basic relationships. There was a great spiritual teacher. He was asked, what's the most important thing of all your teachings? What did he say? Love God with all thy heart. Love thy neighbor as thyself. And if God scares you out of these rooms and you're a real alcoholic, don't worry about it. Booze will scare you back in. We got you. You know, we have a chapter, we agnostics, there's no chapter, we believers. You know, Einstein said this thing that became a principle in my life. A principle is a core belief that becomes the foundation of my life. That principle is I would rather live this life pretending there's a God and finding out there isn't than live this life pretending there's no God and finding out there is. It was just that simple, that I became willing to let go of those old ideas. And you know what I found out? It's so much easier to believe. If people have to change for me to be happy, you know what? My life's going to be miserable. And it seems that when we talk about God being everything or God being nothing, with that power, my life just works. It's like going into a new city without GPS. I am lost. And what I discovered about this power is real simple. God will steer, but God won't row. And that has to be something that makes sense to me, because if it's not that, then I have this delusion that God picks and chooses. And then I start to become separate from that power again. This unconscious separation. There's a poem in Notre Dame. It says, I sought my God I could not see. I sought my soul I could not free. I sought my brother, and I found all three. And that's why we talk about nothing ensures immunity from drinking more than intensive work with others. That real simple idea. And what happened to me is when I walked out of that 28th treatment center, the guy that was running the detox, who was in AA, said, why don't you come back to detox next week, Adam, and tell everybody here how you stayed sober a whole week if you can make it. And for the next 8 years, I sat in 2.5 hours of bumper-to-bumper traffic from one side of L.A. County to the other to tell the guys in detox how I stayed sober a whole week. And what happened is I was tricked into service. And that was the thing that I never really understood, that it was one drunk working with another. That is how this thing is duplicated to what it is. And I thought that I had nothing to offer. And he showed me just in one statement that the defects were preventing me from being of service. I was too selfish to be of service. I was too dishonest because I thought I had nothing to offer. How can you possibly give a newcomer worse advice than they were given themselves? You know what I mean? Or I was too afraid, or I was too resentful. And as I got out of the way and I started going back there, people asked me for help. And I asked my sponsor, and it turned into this. Just a real simple idea. If you're new, I hope that you might get involved with this group. And if there's so many people here, like Larry and you guys that invited me, that know the book like the back of their hand. It's all here. If you want it, it's right here. There's so many people here that'll help you. Thanks.